do. Okay, yeah, thanks for having me here. This is work that I did last year with Mina and Sas, and in progress with experimentalists at MIT and NIST, who are thinking of building a small prototype. And we've teamed up with Masha, Junwoo, and Robert, two of which are in the audience.
You're already interrupting.
Yes.
NIST in Boulder, or is it Gaithersburg?
Sorry?
NIST Boulder,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. So Masha and Robert, and Curly is not here yet, will publish a paper, or will put out their paper on the archive on Friday, or maybe later if they resolve technical issues, which can naturally be joined with the experiment I'll be talking about. Okay, so just to give you some context, so the problems that we particle physicists have is that particle physics works so well already, so to the measured and calculated precision. So there's no discrepancy with the standard model. So how do we make progress? We can try to think of new mathematical structures that may or may not be realized in nature. We can try to explain weird aspects of the standard model, like the small Higgs mass flavor, the theta angle of QCD, or we can try to compute more precisely to find some discrepancy with experiments. But ultimately, progress will come from the experimental front, either through verification of the theories we can come up with, or by finding something completely unexpected. And the classic ways of making progress on the experimental front have been the high energy frontier, smashing things together, or looking to the skies. And they've been, yeah, historically the most successful. But there's a possibility that we've missed something at lower energies. You know, perhaps a very weakly coupled particle that induces very rare events that you can look at in intensity frontier experiments, or a weak effect that you can only tease out with a very precise instrument. And so the experiment I'll be talking about today will be sort of borrowing techniques from both of these areas. And I said the standard model works perfectly, but we've parameterized some of parameterize our ignorance about a few things, the most tangible of which is dark matter. So today will be a dark matter experimental search proposal. All right, so to give you some scales, to give you some context for the scales of dark matter, if it's a fermion or a thermal relic, it better be heavier than about a keV or so. So this is mass versus from the Hubble scale all the way to the Planck scale. And then the classic techniques of looking to the skies or trying to produce them in high energy physics work very well. But we haven't found anything yet, so there's been a lot of effort of trying to push this these traditional direct detection experiments down. At some point, this becomes increasingly difficult, so we might want to do absorption, where instead of depositing a little bit of kinetic energy in a detector like xenon, you absorb the full rest mass of the particle. And so I'll be proposing a similar idea today. And in fact, this absorption, you can extend all the way to lower energies, to what I call macroscopic resonators. So the classic one is ADMX, where you know, you can think of the ADMX cavity as absorbing an axion and exciting a photon state in the cavity. Other techniques are like LC circuits, for example. And instead of approaching it this way and trying to push these direct detection experiments to lower energies, I approached it the other way and try to push these resonator experiments to higher energies. So I'll be taking advantage of some of the highest frequency, the highest energy resonators that nature has to offer, namely molecules. So I already said why absorption is good at low masses, because the energy you absorb is the full rest mass of the particle, not just a little bit of kinetic energy. But resonant absorption is also extremely helpful, because absorption is naturally a narrow band signal. Because if you think about dark matter as a wave, then it oscillates always at the same frequency given by the mass, with a small spread, with a small correction and a small spread given by kinetic energy corrections. And this is about 10 to the minus 6 or 10 to the minus 7 times the in a fractional amount. So you can think of the dark matter wave, this bosonic dark matter wave, as a, you know, your radio station that you're trying to tune into. And the ability to go on and off resonance really helps controlling backgrounds and making sure that it's a real signal instead of a spurious one. And resonance also will boost the absorption cross section.
Could you maybe explain this? So I'm looking at the hermionic matter. So, but the statements there, as I understand, is only true if you have free fields, right? But if you have self-interacting fields, you could actually go to much lower masses?
I think just from Pauli exclusion principle, if it's heavier than a few hundred keV, you cannot pack enough fermions into.
Say if I have, say, two fermions that are interacting, they could form structures, right? So from the outer, say.
Yeah, sure, but then that.
Bosonic and fermionic atoms, right, in general. So, and then bosonic species. They will escape the.
Yeah, but those are still larger than the size of the effective size of electron mass, right?
So if I have a composite boson, right, then I don't need to worry about Pauli exclusion principle anymore.
Yeah, I mean you can think about compact structures, but I'll be talking about very weakly coupled fields that don't interact very strongly with themselves or with a standard model.
Okay. I mean, just on that front, you do need to worry about Pauli exclusion even for, like, say you have electron two pairs. You can't pack more electrons into a box, like making them being Cooper pairs. You're still hitting the Pauli exclusion on the actual fermions themselves.
That's right, of course. But what this is all about, right, is about, this is about large scale. So if you have a composite boson, for example, the BCs of atoms, right? So the atoms are composed out of fermions, as we know, right? You would agree with that, right? But you get a BC, right?
Sure. We should probably go.
Yes, maybe this is a good lunch discussion. So I just wanted to say, so the experiment today, I'll be talking about EV scale dark matter, because that's where most of the molecular transition energies are.
Yes. What is the time axis?
So the mass scale defines a natural length scale, the Compton wavelength, and a natural time scale. So EV dark matter, you can think of, the plane waves of non-relativistic dark matter will oscillate at 10 to the 15 hertz. So the time scale is a femtosecond. That's the frequency. That's the period of oscillation. And the Compton wavelength at an EV is about a micron. So these particles have a Compton wavelength of a micron, and a frequency or an inverse time scale of 10 to the 15 hertz.
So the particle scale, the particle Compton wavelength. It's not some coherent packet of particles. It's the particles that are.
So there's often some confusion about this. So it's a random phase wave. So in a sense, it's like a flashlight. It's kind of like a thermal bath of random plane waves, but because it moves slowly, it actually coherently evolves for 10 to the 6 periods, because most of the frequency of oscillation is set by the mass, which is the same for every single plane wave, and the velocity has an order 1 fractional spread, but it's still small compared to 1, even the dispersion. So you can think of it as a random wave that evolves coherently for 10 to the 6 periods, and then it loses phase coherence.
So the on that 10 to the 6 periods, it's oscillating with the Compton wavelength?
With this 10 to the 15 hertz, yeah.
Where does 10 to the 6 come from? Is it the?
So the velocity is about 10 to the minus 3 locally in our galaxy.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. And the dispersion as well. So the typical velocity is 10 to the minus 3. c, and the typical spread is also 10 to the minus 3 c.
Whatever the
mass is, yes. Okay, so the outline of my talk is in three parts. I'll give you a little bit more intuition about dark matter fields and what types of couplings I'll be probing. A little bit about a review of two-level quantum mechanics and some a little bit about molecules. And then I'll talk about the two experimental configurations we have and how to read out the signal, discriminate, and discriminate against background. And just to remind you again, so I'll be talking about EV scale dark matter particles. So in the previous slide, I showed you many orders of magnitude. This is just two orders of magnitude. But over these two orders of magnitude, we can look for vectors, parity even scalars, and pseudo scalars.
The bottom end of this range is just some experimental thresholds because of the apparatus.
I'll get to it. It's mostly given by black body radiation because and also photon detection becomes hard below that scale. So I'll give you the punchline already. So why is a molecular gas a good dark matter detector? So the main quality that this detector has is discrimination power. So you have incredibly good energy resolution. So it's an intrinsically highly precise system with a small line width. There's also many control variables because you can tune the pressure, the temperature. You can shift the transition energies around with electromagnetic fields to go on and off resonance. You can play with selection rules, and there's a cool directional focusing effect, that we found that can focus your signal in a narrow direction. Okay.
Can you explain that, or are you going to talk more about
it? I will talk. I cannot explain that yet, but I will. I said we can look for vectors and scalars and pseudoscalars. So for vectors, you can write down a kinetically mixed hidden photon. So A prime is like a new photon, except it's massive. This is the ordinary electromagnetic current. But instead of the coupling constant being E, which is a third or so, now it's a third times the small mixing parameter epsilon. You can also couple to baryon minus lepton number currents with a small gauge coupling G.
And totally identical. Huh? The E is inside J mu.
Sorry. Okay, yeah. Or an A, whatever. But you can also. So I'm talking about couplings to molecules. So the relevant degrees of freedom are coupling to electrons and nuclei and electromagnetic field energy. So I can rephrase this in terms of couplings to electrons, quarks, photons, and gluons. So here are the leading operators for parity even scalars to electrons, quarks, photons, and gluons, and the same for parity odd ones. And so it turns out that that with this experiment, we can probe new parameter space for 9 out of 10 of these couplings, except for that one. That one's suppressed in an atom. I'll show you sensitivity plots at the end. Okay, so to come back to Sam's question, so how do you think of bosonic dark matter fields? So if you solve the equations of motion for a vector, scalar, pseudoscalar, the solutions are non-relativistic plane waves. So you can forget about the momentum to first approximation, and the amplitude is proportional to the energy density of the field, or which I take to be all of the dark matter, divided by the mass or the energy. And it oscillates at a frequency that's mostly given by the mass. So if I Fourier transform this ensemble of fields and I plot the energy density, the differential energy density as a function of energy, then all of the particles have mass, at least mass, energy m, the mass, and then there's some spread given by the mv squared. Yes?
So how do you define this upper 20 eV limit? Because this would suppose that you can still describe it as a cosine wave.
Yes, yes.
One particle per de Broglie
volume actually happens at about 7 eV.
Okay.
So it's not the fact that you can no longer. It's true that above 7 eV, this classical approximation breaks down, but the effective time average formulas are still correct. The 20 eV cutoff is because you run out of resonant molecular transitions above 20 eV. Because the hydrogen has an ionization energy of 13 eV, right?
But why can you still describe it as a plane wave assumption?
So that breaks down, but we show in our paper, I don't have time to talk about that, but we show in our paper that when this breaks down, the effective absorption formula still hold true over if you average over long time scales. Okay, so you can think of it, so in frequency space, this is a very narrow spread. This is 10 to the minus 6 fractional spread. So delta omega is 10 to the minus 6 of the mass. There's various ways of producing such an ensemble of plane waves. For a spin 1 particle, you can produce it in inflation, and for a spin 0, the field can be naturally displaced from its minimum, which is called a misalignment mechanism. And to give you some intuition for how big the dark matter field is, let me use this hidden photon. So it's just like an ordinary photon, but then with a rescaled coupling. So this is Lagrangian. If you write down the non-relativistic, Hamiltonian for this, you just get the leading order. You get the normal electric dipole operator times now this hidden electric field times this epsilon. And so you can compute this E prime, this hidden electric field, with this formula. And E prime is just square root of 2 times the dark matter energy density, which in engineering units is 3 kilovolts per meter, which is enormous. That's the same as standing in front of this laser if you focus it to a 1 square meter beam waste area. So this just goes to show how intense this field is. So this is why you can go down to tiny couplings, epsilon.
Do you happen to know that number in Tesla?
It's less than a Tesla. So in EV, a Tesla is 200 EV squared, and this is fractions of a square EV. So it's smaller than a Tesla, but. Okay, so some basics about a two-level system. So what I'll be talking about is a ground state and an excited state with some gap, omega naught, and the excited state can radiate a photon. And so those 10 couplings I wrote down on the two slides before, you can calculate the non-relativistic Hamiltonian, and in general, they will have some matrix element from the ground state to the excited state, which means you can excite it. And I'll parameterize the strength of this matrix element by this Rabi frequency capital omega. And the field, the dark matter field oscillates at little omega. So what it is you start in the ground state, your dark matter field perturbs coherently the ground state. So you have some probability of being in the excited state, which can radiate a photon and which you then detect. So if you do this exercise in quantum mechanics, you find that the absorption rate is the total number of molecules you have in your system, which is just its number density times the volume. The rate goes like this matrix element squared divided by some effective width, little gamma, on resonance, and then off resonance. So off resonance, it is suppressed by this Lorentzian line shape factor. And so the on resonance absorption rate is larger than off resonance by roughly gamma over omega naught. So there's a few things that go into this line width. So there's the radiative rate of the molecule. So you cut off the resonance every time you decay. There's also a possibility for the molecules colliding with each other. And there's also the finite width of your perturbing wave itself. So it turns out that in most of the situations of interest, you want to be at relatively high number density, and gamma is essentially set by this collisional width. And this has a cool feature, which is that on resonance, your absorption rate is independent of the number of molecules if you're in this regime, if gamma is limited by this. because naively, as you lower the number density, you lose, you know, you lose effective target, but gamma reduces as well, so on resonance you have the same absorption rate, which really helps. Backgrounds don't have this scaling behavior. And there's also a cool effect, which is that the Doppler width is negligible because you're absorbing a non-relativistic wave instead of a relativistic particle.
So in principle, I'm just trying to. So in principle, you are tuning a molecular system.
Or I'll get to that next.
Okay.
You can tune it. Yeah.
And then, so for a given, once you've set that.
If I had one level only, if it was truly a two-level system, I could only absorb particles with a mass of order omega naught, and not many. I mean, my absorption rate would be extremely suppressed away from that scale.
So, explain why is it not actually suppressed?
It's not suppressed because on resonance, your absorption cross section is enhanced. It's enhanced by coherence time, which is basically the inverse collision time, and that's the collision rate is proportional to n. So, of course, in the limit of zero molecules, at some point the scaling is no longer valid. I can explain it a little bit better. So in quantum mechanics, you start from a ground state and you perturb it with your interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture. And so at short times, before you radiate, before you collide, or before the dark matter wave is dephased, you rotate the ground state into the excited state. So this is your transition amplitude. And if you're exactly on resonance, let's take these two to be equal, then this factor, this big fraction here, grows linearly in time. So your transition amplitude goes like T, which means your population in the excited state goes like T squared. It's not a constant rate. It's like T squared. So your rate is growing in time. And it's growing in time until, you know, this picture is no longer valid. And this picture is no longer valid when you have spontaneous emission or your molecules collide and dephase the dark matter wave relative to the atomic system, or your dark matter wave itself dephases. So it's the long time between collisions that is enhancing the absorption cross section.
So essentially, can you just say that you have significant collisional broadening to the point that essentially you're going from resonant absorption to somewhat broadband?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
of the collisions.
Yes. Yes. And I'll show you a more detailed example. Okay, the Sam's question. So traditional absorption targets have been solids or liquids where you have a continuum of transition energies. So for example, this could be just some quasi-particle excitation spectrum like a conduction band, and this could be a phonon spectrum, for example. But these systems are very difficult to tune, but they have the advantage that you can absorb energy at many frequencies. You can absorb there's no gaps usually. An atom is a very good resonator, but unfortunately it's extremely sparse, and usually it has a large gap as well. And it's impossible to tune these levels by order one with just some external handles like electric fields. So a diatomic molecule is kind of like the optimal geometric mean between one atom and infinite number of atoms, because even just two atoms, you introduce a whole forest of fine structure. So first of all, the few electronic levels of the atomic state are now split, because instead of spherical symmetry, you have only cylindrical symmetry in a diatomic molecule. So there's more electronic levels, so these blue lines. You have vibrational degrees of freedom, so these stretching modes of the molecule, which are down from a Rydberg, so the typical electronic splitting, by this Born-Oppenheimer factor, which is the ratio of the electron mass over the reduced mass of the nuclei to the 1/2 power, which is usually about a factor of 1/30th or 1/100th down. And so there's many of these vibrational levels. So these purple lines. There's a spectrum of vibrational levels for each electronic state. And then on top of that, there's rotational levels, which is another Born-Oppenheimer factor down. So if you think of the hydrogen atom, there's maybe a handful, like 5 levels below 12 eV. But H2, the hydrogen gas, the molecule, has 5,000 lines below 12 eV because of this discretum of transition energies. So in a sense, it's a multimode resonator. It's like building 5,000 ADMX cavities at once, because you're in the ground state and you can be dark matter can excite to any of these 5,000 levels. It's an effective multimode resonator. And this means that to get uniform energy coverage, you only need to scan by order the rotational fine structure.
What percentage of your molecules actually are in the ground state?
Good. So to give you some reference, so this electronic energy splitting is usually of order eV to 10 eV. Vibrational splittings are of order half an eV to 0.1 eV. And these are pretty low. So normally, I start in thermal equilibrium, let's say at 100 Kelvin, and typically the first, it depends on how heavy your molecule is, but let's say, I'll show you, for carbon monoxide, which is roughly, the reduced mass is roughly 10 proton masses, there's roughly the first 10 rotational levels are occupied. But none in the first vibrational level or in the first excited. So it's usually a handful, 10 to maybe sometimes 50 of the first rotational levels are occupied, and all the other ones are exponentially rare.
So in EV, what's the rotational splitting typically?
For what?
In electron volts, what's the rotational splitting typically?
So it depends.
Carbon monoxide.
So for carbon monoxide, the rotational splitting, I think, is of order, it's on the next slide, 10 to the minus 4 eV, I think. That's the usual splitting. I know for hydrogen, it's 6 milli eV. But that's the high, because hydrogen is the lowest mass, it's the highest rotational splitting. So all of the molecules are below 6 milli eV. It's usually 10 to the minus 4 for relatively small ones. Okay, so this is carbon monoxide. So here I've shown you this process. So the exciting from the ground state to the first vibrational eigenstate.
Before you the very stupid question.
Yeah.
So how, like for something like ADMX, which is just the cavity, that's essentially, that's the analog of the atom where you only
have
a single.
Yes, yes, yeah. So the process that I'm going to show now is this process to the first vibrational eigenstate, but I can go from any one of the populated rotational states to any one of these rotational states. So what that looks like is this. So this is, as a function of energy or dark matter mass, you get some absorption rate in hertz, so per second. So this is one absorption event per second. And I've chosen a fiducial value that's not yet excluded of 10 to the minus 12 mixing angle, and a volume on the scale of 10 centimeters at 100 Kelvin and a pressure of 5 bar. So what is shown here is that, so you have two bands, this band and that band. Here you go down in rotational transition energy. So here's from the first excited rotational level to zero rotational quantum numbers. This is from J equals 2 to J equals 1. This is from J equals, if you start in J equals 5, you can go to 4, but you can also go to plus 1, which is 6. There's about 30 lines in here.
And the overall frequency is what?
It's not
actually symmetric, right?
It's not exactly symmetric.
So what's the actual tilt from?
The tilt is because, there's selection rules. So this, the J quantum number can only change by plus 1 or minus 1. But if you start in J equals 0, of course, only plus 1 is available. So that's why it's slightly asymmetric.
Slightly symmetric.
Yeah. And so this rotational splitting, yet, so to get back, so this is of order 10% fractional width. And the splitting, well, you can read it off. It's of order, I think it's of order 10 to the minus 4 EV or so. A few times 10 to the minus 4 EV.
And if you increase the pressure and temperature, do the lines just broaden? Is that
the yeah, I'll show you the effect of the pressure in a second. If you were to increase the pressure, what it means is that more J levels are initially occupied. So that slightly lowers the absorption rate, but extends it farther. Because, you know, this would be like J equals 11 to 12, right? But at higher temperatures, there's a higher probability of being in J equals 11. So this line goes up, but these ones go down. And likewise, it will extend farther that way. And lowering the temperature is the opposite effect. If you lower the pressure to, let's say, by a factor of 100, so you go from 5 bar to 5 millibar, now the absorption spectrum is much more narrow. And this is precisely because this collisional broadening, which was limiting the width of these lines, is now turned off by a factor of 100. So the lines are 100 times more narrow, but with the same absorption rate on resonance. And so off resonance, roughly, the absorption rate is suppressed by 10 to the 4. Which means that if you were to see a signal, let's say, at this energy, you can lower the pressure and see if it's still there and tune the lines around.
So how many molecules in the body?
Avogadro number, a few times Avogadro number, yeah. I don't know exactly.
How do you move the lines?
I will get to that.
The breakdown in that, and the fact that they get to the same height on resonance,
yeah.
That only comes when you have less than one particle per volume? Or?
No, that comes when... So that comes when the radiative width kicks in. So at some point, at very low pressures, the width is at very low pressures. This becomes negligible, and then you're limited by either the fractional line width of dark matter, which doesn't scale with number density, obviously, or the radiative width in some cases. That's spontaneous emission. There are coherent enhancement effects too. I'll get to that later. But yeah, roughly speaking, at 1 millibar, this effect is no longer operational. So basically, this is 50 millibar. If I were to drop the pressure by another factor of 50 at that point, the on-resonance absorption rate would start to go down.
What happens if you increase the pressure? I mean, nothing much.
So at 7 bar and at this temperature, carbon monoxide becomes a liquid. Okay. But yeah. So you see here that the width is already of order, almost of order to rotational splitting, right? So in an initial dark matter search, you want relatively high pressure to cover as much energy. Yeah. Okay, so how are we doing on time? Okay, that was good. So now I'll talk about the experimental setup, now that you know all of the physics. So there's two setups. There's a simple one, which we call the bulk configuration, which is just a black box shielded as well as you can, filled with molecules, which is this blue bulk volume, and surrounded by reflective coatings, supposedly on all sides, but I only drew 4 of the 6 sides, so you can see it. So the idea is that dark matter gets absorbed somewhere in the middle. Oops, this pointer doesn't work. Dark matter gets absorbed somewhere in the middle, excites a molecule which then fluoresces in a random direction, and so you bounce off the reflective walls a few times and eventually it'll hit a photodetector. And so we have two phases, so a simple prototype phase of 30 centimeters in size at room temperature and with a photodetector with a dark count rate of 1 hertz, so the minimum photon, even without a signal, the photodetector clicks 1 times per second.
DCR?
Dark count rate. So it's the rate at which your photodetector clicks and thinks it sees a single photon, even without a signal. So it's usually some technical noise.
The DCR, is that the reason why you don't just line the box with photodetectors?
Yeah. So for these large area photodetectors like PMTs or CCDs, the DCR scales like the area. So that's why... Yeah, your reflective coatings, if you want them broadband, they can have 99% reflectance. So this can be 1% of the boundary area of the box.
Why don't you worry about optical depth at all?
Yeah.
Because you have the same selection rules.
Yes. So that's a very good question. So optical depth is not an it is an issue for allowed transitions. Mm-hmm. For forbidden transitions, so you can it's not as much of an issue. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do allowed transitions, what you can do is what often happens, especially for electronic transitions. So this is the ground state. This would be some allowed transition by dark matter. If you decay back down and emit a photon, that photon will be reabsorbed before it hits the photodetector, and that would be bad. But you can arrange a situation, especially for electronic levels, where you decay back down and emit a photon of this energy, and so your whole sample will be in the ground state, and this energy, you know, will not excite, cannot excite a resonance. So that's what you need to do. Yeah, that's a good question. And so a phase two experiment would just be scaled up and use cryogenic photodetectors. But significant R&D needs to be done to scale them up to a large area.
So one of the obvious background would be that if the population is not 100% in the ground state.
I'll get to that. Yeah. So yes, the population is not in the ground state, or you can say that in my box I have a thermal population of photons already, which you know, has some exponential tail that may overlap with my signal band. So that's there's a black body background that you need to take into account. Okay, so that was a simple detector. There's a cool version of the detector that makes use of the spatial coherence properties of dark matter. So I said dark matter is some ensemble of non-relativistic plane waves, and roughly the velocity function, so the velocity distribution, is Maxwell-Boltzmann with some velocity dispersion. It's roughly 10 to the minus 3 c. There's some average velocity of the dark matter in the lab frame. But the key thing to note is that the typical velocities are small relative to the speed of light, which means that so at an EV, your Compton wavelength is about 1 micron, but your coherence length, so the length over which your dark matter wave is a coherent cosine, if you wish, is 10 to the 3 times larger because of the small velocity here. So your dark matter wave is spatially coherent and has the same phase over a millimeter instead of a micron, whereas a photon of the same energy has a micron-sized wavelength. So let's do the following exercise. Let's construct a little slab that's a micron on a side, so a word of this coherence length, and a micron thick. So that means that if my dark matter wave passes through, you know, it's mostly in the ground state, but I have some small probability amplitude of being in the excited state. And because the dark matter wave is in phase over my whole box, the dark matter wave imprints the same phase on each of the molecules. So my total state in the system is just this state to the nth power. So all of my molecules have the same phase, so they get excited and they oscillate because of this factor here at the same frequency. So I have coherent emitters, and if I have two coherent emitters in the same phase, I get constructive interference in the normal direction. And destructive interference in this one, constructive again that way. And I can sum up all of the emission amplitudes for all of the pairs in here, and what I get is an emission pattern. So as a function of angle, this constructive interference in the normal direction to the slab survives. So if I put a screen above my slab, I get, so this is the normal direction. I expect to find all of my emission photons close to the normal direction. And it's actually slightly displaced by this projection of the lab velocity onto the plane of the slab. So this is in units of the speed of light or in radians. So this is about a milliradian or so. And the spread of my emission cone is given by the velocity dispersion, which is, again, on the order of a milliradian or so. So what this means is that my photons are emitted, collimated, all in the normal direction.
Is that contour plot in angle?
This is an angle. No, this is a screen. Oh, yeah, this is an angle also. Yeah, yeah. But if my screen is this, yeah, it's an angle. Yeah. So this leads to the following type of experimental setup. So imagine if I had a bunch of these slabs stacked together with some transparent material like a silicon, for example. Between them. So I get, from each slab, I get emission in the normal direction that's highly collimated, and I can then focus that down with some parabolic mirror or parabolic lens onto a much smaller photodetector. Because it's collimated, I have space opportunities to focus it down onto a photodetector that, so if this is a meter or so, I can focus it down onto a millimeter-sized photodetector, which helps cut down on dark count rates, because now I only need a tiny little area, so I can make that some fancy cryogenic device. Yeah.
I'm still puzzled. Why do you actually need the stripes? Because you can also think that your entire material is sort of coherent in all directions. But then
yes.
It's essentially just a focusing device.
Yes, it's a focusing device. If I were to fill these dielectrics with molecules as well, then I would get destructive interference between that one and that one. Yeah. So if I do this, you know, 1D system, I get a periodic structure in this dimension which focuses the photons in that dimension, or collimates the photons.
So just to ask, what exactly is D here?
D is the integrated thickness of all of the slabs.
That would be about 1,000 layers at.
1,000 layers at 1 micron. They don't all need to be coherently added, right? Or I can make the layers 10 microns too. There's some optimization to be done. So we have a phase one experiment, which is again at the sort of tens of centimeter scale, and then a more aggressive version with the higher volume.
When you make this disk, what's the structure of the, I mean, you're making an empty...
Which disk?
Of the actual,
the slab, yeah.
That's some, you're pumping in a gas into that?
Yeah, so you want to build a layered stack with vacuum in between and some holes to pump in your gas, yeah. But the holes don't need to be that big, yeah.
So you are basically talking about Stuttgart radians, right? And in atomic systems, it's for some reason people have not observed even
been observed in this effect that I'm describing here has not been observed in atomic systems, precisely because this long range spatial coherence is not a feature of a relativistic wave. It's a feature of a non-relativistic wave.
I think you're relying on assumptions on velocity spread.
But you know,
for example, sitting in dark matter stream.
That can only help.
Yeah.
That can only help.
So, is there any effects which actually will, you know, produce longer coherences?
Yeah, like what you said, sitting in a velocity stream, mm-hmm. that would help.
Would just being close to the, you know, the Earth as a massive body, extra enhancements?
The solar system doesn't do very much. It focuses a little bit at, you know, some months of the year, but it's not a large effect. Okay. For carbon monoxide, what you get is so there is some inefficiency. So what you need is. I haven't explained it in great detail, but what you need is for the photons to be coherently emitted before they collide. So there is some decoherence which destroys this effect. So you, what you want is you want to have several slabs add coherently to enhance this coherence efficiency. And so if your coherence efficiency is not equal to 1, your signal rate is, your coherent emission rate is down from your absorption rate here by a factor of 100. And that's because carbon monoxide does not radiate that efficiently. But if you added 10 slabs together, then this would go up a factor of 10. Or if you use a molecule with a larger matrix element, then you can saturate this.
But here you're showing a very small part of this 0.2 eV.
Yeah, so this is a 10% fractional spread. You can do an experiment for a day and then pump in a new gas of molecules with a different absorption spectrum. Or you can, this is actually oxygen 18 instead of oxygen 16. So if you change isotope, you shift around your transition energies also. Okay. So what are the key considerations are that you cover a large range of frequencies and that you get your photons out. So to cover a large range of frequencies, I already said you can increase the number density, and that takes you from a narrow set of lines to a broader set of lines. So you can broaden them. You can change your molecule and shift around your absorption spectrum. And you can also tune your resonances with the magnetic field. So if you had an absorption where you had a spin flip involved, like what you could have with an axion, if you put your box in a magnetic field, you split each absorption line into a doublet of, say, spin up and spin down if it's a spin 1/2 system. And in a 10 Tesla field, you can make the splitting of the doublet of order the rotational splitting, typically. So you can achieve 10 to the minus 4 eV Zeeman shifts in a magnetic field. In an electric field, you can do the same thing. So Stark shifts you can do for molecules with an electric dipole moment in molecule fixed coordinates. And again, you can tune of order the rotational splitting. For radiative efficiency, so in the bulk configuration, you want the molecules to spontaneously emit a photon before they get quenched. So before your internal excitation energies converted into translational energy, for example, to heat. And in the stack configuration, you want to cooperatively emit a photon before you decohere, so before the molecules collide. But you can get these radiative efficiencies of order 1. And so for in terms of photodetection, so for the bulk phase 1, we were thinking of a PMT or a CCD, which has on the order of 1 hertz dark count rates for PMT and better for newly developed CCDs. For the bulk phase 2, you need a large area cryogenic photodetector. And so Ben Mazin here at UCSD has developed 20 kilopixel MKIDs that are of order a quarter size. They can be used in the stack as well, but there the requirements are not as stringent because you only need of order 100 micron or 1 millimeter sized detector. And we're talking to these experimentalists at NIST and MIT, say Wu Nam and Carl Berggren, who've developed superconducting nanowires that are extremely good.
Yeah. Take one of Ben's already existing
For the stack experiment, yes. So these are optimized for so the photo set. So this is 20,000 pixels, but each little pixel has only 10% photosensitive area, and you can get away with that because for each pixel, he has a tiny little micro lens that focuses the photons on the photosensitive area. But for the bulk, in the bulk phase. For the bulk case, your photons are emitted isotropically, and you take a hit there. So there needs to be some R&D for the bulk phase. But for the stack phase, yes, because there you have the same thing. Your photons are collimated to some degree.
For these detectors, what's the coverage and energy, photon energy?
They can so their thresholds are way below 100 milliEV. But single photon detection at low dark count rate has not been demonstrated you know, far below below 0.2 eV. But they can go from 0.2 eV to the UV, even X-ray.
What about the PMT?
The PMT, so if it's a, or a CCD, if it's a silicon-based material, then they cannot go below the work function. So below 1 eV, that's hard. Yeah, so basically this would be good for EV and above, and this is good at all energies.
So this limits the...
The range. Yeah, but yes, it does. It does.
I was a bit confused about your previous slide.
Mm-hmm.
So collisions are good for frequency coverage, but bad for decoherence.
Right, right.
So, I mean, is there any case where you can't do both? I mean,
You can enhance this by having multiple stacks. Yeah, the cooperative emission.
Okay.
Yeah.
But does that stop you this collision or broadening from happening?
So in the limit of zero background, you want this. You can make this as broad. You want this to be as broad as possible. You don't want to lose. There's an optimization that you need to do, but this cooperative emission, this coherence efficiency, doesn't scale with the number density. Maybe that takes a longer time to explain, but I'm running out of time. Yeah.
Can you explain why you don't have a Doppler broadening?
In the room, for example. Regular air molecules at room temperature, the Doppler width is 10 to the minus 5 fractionally, and that 10 to the minus 5 comes from the fact that the typical speed of molecules in this room is 10 to the minus 5 times the speed of light, and the Doppler shift fractionally is the speed of the absorbed particle dotted into the velocity of the absorbing particle. But because dark matter moves slowly, it's actually the 10 to the minus 3 velocity dotted into the 10 to the minus 5 velocity of the molecule. So the Doppler width is 10 to the minus 8 at room temperature, and at 100 Kelvin it's 10 to the minus, you know, it's even lower than that. So it's totally negligible compared to the frequency width of the dark matter wave itself, which is another cool effect. Yeah?
So, one thing is that, just looking at your skin, so mm-hmm. you do rely on selection rules.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Basically, it means that, say, if I were to rely on parity of that operator,
mm-hmm.
right, I would it requires the ground state is of a given parity.
Right.
But
right.
Usually, if you have an electric field or mm-hmm. like some patch charges that people worry mm-hmm. about a lot, okay, you get this electric field, and for some molecules you could get. Omega or lambda doubling, which basically mixes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And then I think you're in trouble, right?
I'm not in trouble, but you do. I do agree. You do change the selection rules, but you need to make sure that your selection rules don't change in such a way that you cannot look for the particle of interest anymore.
But electric field, it always is going to break.
It will break some symmetries and some selection
so it will
rules.
Break parity, and
yes. Yes, by a controllable amount. The selection rules are only are mostly helpful to if you see a signal to determine whether it's a spurious thing or whether it's a real thing. But we're not making critical use of that in sort of an initial search. It would only be for like a further follow-up study of the signal. And it's also helpful to look for highly forbidden transitions, because then several backgrounds from radioactivity or cosmic rays are suppressed. But yes, if you turn on an electric field, the validity of the selection rules is not as good. Okay. So the main backgrounds in the experiment are the technical noise in the detector, this DCR, which is bad for PMTs and CCDs, but cryogenic photodetectors like these superconducting nanowire single photon detectors, these microwave kinetic inductance devices, and transition edge sensors essentially have no technical noise, zero dark ant rate far above their energy threshold. Although for many applications, dark ant rate studies have not yet been performed, but the experimentalists we're working with at NIST and MIT have demonstrated a nanowire detector of 50 microns in size that had 6 dark ant rates per day without making significant efforts to build it out of low radioactive materials or shield it. So this was at the surface, and they had 6 dark ant rates per day. There are thermal backgrounds, which you can think of as black body backgrounds. Yes? Yes. So basically, without trying, they got 10 to the minus 5 hertz. So we think with trying, you can get down to 10 to the minus 7. Although, if it's below 10 to the minus 5, at that point, you've already saturated.
In those devices, what was the threshold, and what was the range in which they were looking at dark counts? How far above the threshold was it?
So that experiment was at 400 nanometers. So that's 3 eV. And they make them out of several materials, so I don't know. They make them out of tungsten and other materials, but the threshold is usually measured in milli EVs, so it's far above the threshold. Yeah. So in my sensitivity plots, which I'll show momentarily, I'll show these two backgrounds. We think you can suppress radioactive backgrounds and cosmic rays to a negligible level. In the bulk phase, they're hard. In this stack configuration, it almost automatically rejects these. In the bulk case, you need a high purity shield and components of your photodetector with a low fraction of, say, uranium-238. Xenon has, for example, a lead shield with a 10 to the minus 12 mass fraction of uranium-238. And in a meter scale volume, this gives you a radioactive decay rate of 10 to the minus 2 hertz. Of course, the radioactive decay comes with many particles, ionizes stuff. You can do, and when you see that, you can do a timing veto. The stack configuration rejects most backgrounds because you're only looking at photons in a tiny solid angle already. But so this should be doable. And muons, likewise, muons will be subdominant to radioactive decays, and you can veto them to some extent as well.
Do you not have to be underground?
For the bulk phase 2, you would have to be underground. For the other ones, no.
As in mine, or as in...
Not quite Snow Lab, it depends on your timing resolution and your and how well you can veto muons. But it's not as stringent as xenon, for example. Yeah.
Sorry, wouldn't the muon passing through just like light it up in a completely different
yes.
range?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So you can veto that. You likewise. Yeah. It's the same veto will typically work for.
Well, you can't veto it with a setup that you already have, like without putting in an extra.
For the stack configuration, the photon number resolving power is not that great. And you could have, for example, let's say a muon produces 1,000 photons. You know, most of them go off in a solid angle that's not this narrow emission cone, and you lose them, and you might get one in your photodetector, right? So, but you need to put some scintillating material around it to veto.
Isn't the energy of those photons like many EV?
That could be many EV, but you have cascades down, right? And so your particle will lose energy and excite some vibrational levels, the same ones that you're looking for. Yeah.
So black body radiation also is going to induce transitions.
Yes. But in therm, I'm assuming thermal equilibrium. So I can. Yeah.
So if you don't actually. Even deal with this issue of preparing your sample in the ground state,
mm-hmm.
then still you have black body radiation photons that will drive population to.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not doing fancy tricks to produce it in exactly the ground state. I'm assuming I'm in thermal equilibrium. Uh-huh. And so I have a thermal state, thermal occupancy of my excited levels, and I have a thermal state of my photon bath.
That number is going to fluctuate, so you're going to get
You're going to get black body counts in your detector.
Right.
Yes.
How do you distinguish between the.
You need to cool down, and a black body. You can also look for bumps on a black body spectrum as well, right? The black body spectrum should be smooth. I can look for small bumps on top of it, but yeah, that's a definitely a limiting factor, as you'll see in a second.
Okay.
So I'm running out of time. So.
We have 30 more minutes till they come yell at us.
So. Oh, okay. I'm almost done. Yeah. So you can discriminate signal versus background by looking at the scaling with number density. You can shift around with species, isotopes, or electric fields go on and off resonance, and backgrounds do not care to leading order what this resonance frequency is. There's selection rules that you can use to distinguish between spurious things and dark matter signals. And of course, backgrounds will typically emit will cause photon emission at all angles and not in this direction, in this highly focused direction. Okay, so let's get on to the sensitivity plots. So what I didn't show you today was how you can get from all of those bosonic dark matter couplings to non-relativistic operators for all of these particles. We did that in our paper, and so you can work out all the cool selection rules. It's a fun problem. So this is the sensitivity plot for a hidden photon. So this is this kinetic mixing from 10 to the minus 10 to 10 to the minus 18 as a function of mass. So from fractions of an EV to 20 EV or so. There's solar emission bounds from hidden photons, as well as a dark matter bound from xenon 10. And with a bulk phase 1 detector, this really simple 30-centimeter detector with a PMT at room temperature, we think you can already do better by two orders of magnitude. And so typically, above an EV, you're limited solely by just signal events or dark count rate. And at low energies, this is the black exponential black body tail.
Yes. Kind of a box?
Yeah, so above a few EV or 1.5 EV, you can look for electronic transitions. And below 0.5 EV, you look for vibrational transitions, ones that change the vibrational quantum by one unit. There's kind of a gap in between, and so there you're relying on vibrational transitions with two, where you change the vibrational quantum number by two, but those are suppressed by anharmonic effects, so that's why the sensitivity is worse, like in this region.
And what are those, the H2s?
Yeah. So this is like naive dimensional analysis. This is for a few months experiments using different molecules. We think you can populate this whole space. And here I've shown you what you can do with iodine, for example, in a day. So iodine has on the order of several tens of thousand lines, which I all plotted here. So you can cover between 2 and 3 EV, which is roughly visible wavelengths. Iodine looks pink. And so this is what you can do in a day. So you can see you can saturate this bound. And so with 10 molecules, you can sort of fill in this range.
What's the best scanning procedure to sort of fill in that range?
So iodine actually has such, because it's heavy, it's 127 protons, one iodine atom. So its rotational splitting is actually of order the dark matter width. So actually, it's almost a continuum in a sense. And there's several halogen molecules that have this feature. So you actually don't need to scan with electric field necessarily. But yeah, so in the bulk phase, for most molecules, we would scan with electric field a little bit. And in the stack phase, you can broaden with pressure. We would broaden with pressure or change molecules.
So the stage one turn up is using PMTs as opposed to the black body.
This is the black body count. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And I cut it off roughly at the band gap of silicon at 1.1 EV. Yeah. And so with the stack detectors, you can do much better because you don't have to. Yeah, because you have lower dark count rates. And so with a very optimistic stack phase 2 detector, we think you can go down to 10 to the minus 18, for example. So this H2 line would be the stack phase 2 detector with hydrogen in it for, I believe, a few days.
Why is there anything inherent about hydrogen that makes it more suitable for?
No, so these are more aggressive parameters. So this is stack bulk phase one with a day and a small volume. This is a much better photodetector. Here, I'm assuming, for these lines, I'm assuming a much better photodetector, a larger volume. Yeah.
But the iodine would also be going down.
Iodine would similarly be going down, yeah. Although, yeah.
So I'll
Can you explain why the iodine has the bumps in the middle?
So these are different vibrational. So it's one. This B stands for one electronic transition. But all the bumps are different vibrational bands, each with. So this thing is one vibrational band, each with its own fine structure. Rotational fine structure, and there's a bunch of overlapping ones, and it's a messy spectrum.
And just because it's heavier, you don't see that in the same thing in
H. Yeah, actually, for carbon monoxide, the vibrational bands don't overlap. So each of this line is actually a set of narrow lines, and this is change in vibrational quantum 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's just for iodine that they overlap.
So the carbon monoxide is a before scanning plot?
No, that is after. This is so roughly each line covers 20%, I think, fractional width. Yeah, the width of the line is 20%, the difference between the lines. But with different isotopes, you can fill in continuously.
What is your ideal molecule? Like, if you want to.
These are pretty good because you see that you can saturate the optimum case. Yeah, you have to use 20 or 30 molecules to fill in this whole range.
Wouldn't going to polyatomic molecules make it better because you have more levels, or it just gets too
cold? No, that would help. And so we're actually thinking of using ClO2, chlorine dioxide. If you get to too large a molecule, they can have internal transitions to heat. So you can excite an electronic transition that then excites through vibronic couplings, it excites rotational modes of your molecule. So it sort of cascades down internally without emitting a photon. That would be bad. But yeah, small polyatomics, methane, or triatomic molecules would still be good, but not large organic molecules.
Ritberg atoms or something?
Sorry?
Would Ritberg atoms be useful, or do you have some very...
Yeah, but it's hard to get large numbers of them. Yeah, because Ritberg, you would have to prepare them in a high occupancy state already, so that's hard.
So there's also, your block says solar emission, so you also get the fine metallic sun. I mean, you do lose all the nice benefits of having a monochromatic...
Exactly.
Because
it's such a wide range of energies, you lose. The only reason why we can compete with solid state detectors is because we get this on resonance enhancement, right? And that helps you for a narrow band signal, but it no longer helps you for a broad signal. So there, you would build a liquid target or a phonon target.
Actually, not use the existing dark matter, but actually source dark photons.
You can try, but no, it's very difficult to. Yeah, you can do some estimates, but it's really difficult.
Like if you know, run numbers.
No, 10 to the minus 18 is roughly gravitational coupling. So if you can produce 10 to the minus 18 hidden photons, you can produce gravitational waves in the lab as well.
Okay.
So here I've shown you. So this is roughly gravitational coupling. So this is for a B minus L gauge boson. It's roughly the same plot, except now you have fifth force constraints and decay of your hidden photon to neutrinos. You can look for scalars as well. So this, yes. This is the decay. So on this line, you decay to neutrinos in 10 billion years, any one particle. So above this line, they would all be depleted. And actually, there would be a significant constraints even just below this line from just seeing the decay products of these B minus L gauge bosons.
Okay.
can you clarify then? Excluded the buffer below the line?
It's excluded above this line. Yeah, it cannot be all of the dark matter. Yes.
And what's a gray? Oh, excuse me, a green line?
The green line is roughly is a visual aid for where the gauge coupling is this is such that it gives you gravitational strength coupling.
So the dotted line is just in a particular model? Or?
No, this is if you couple to leptons, if you couple to neutrinos as well, your massive gauge boson can decay to a neutrino antineutrino pair.
Okay, so all of these.
These are not interesting. That's excluded. Yeah.
Because technically, this bound goes away just to the left of the edge of your plot.
Right. Yeah, but the lightest neutrino. There might be a kink here. Yeah. Okay, so we're running really out of time. So you could look for scalar, so a modulus coupled to electrons only. Again, the same plot. So there's bounds from red giant cooling and fifth forces. But so this is the prediction you would get for a Higgs portal coupling. So a particle that couples like this with some dimensionful constant. So that space, that model space, is below this green line, which you can look for with phase two type of experiments. That is relative to gravity. So this is my units are.
We can't see.
So in the Lagrangian, this is this DME. So it's their relic from dilaton couplings. But so this is phi times the electron mass operator divided by M Planck. So roughly, if DME is 1, then it's a gravitational, sort of a scalar graviton for a dilaton. And so we can probe couplings that are 10 to the 5 times gravity.
And your Higgs portal band starts from some unitary
bound? So basically, A has to be larger, A has to be smaller than the mass of the scalar. Otherwise, you don't have a stable potential.
How do you define the natural limit?
So this scalar is a hierarchy problem because I can close the electron loop. And so the natural line is where the mass correction from this coupling does not exceed the physical mass that I've assumed on the x-axis for a cutoff of 10 TeV. So just to show that this is all natural, untuned parameter space.
Sorry, isn't this kind of a coupling something you can also constrain by measuring, variation of the electron mass?
It is variation of the electron mass, but just at such a high frequency that you wouldn't measure it in ordinary physics. And it's also a tiny, I think on this line,
I know in ordinary physics you would,
but. Yeah, but on this line, the electron mass oscillates by a fractional amount of 10 to the minus 25. Which is way too small to observe by any other means. So you can also look for moduli coupled to photons in the same way, to quarks and gluons, because they can excite vibrational transitions. You can look for...
How close do you get to gravity?
This is 100 times gravity in coupling. So roughly 10,000 times gravity in coupling, 10 to the 8 times in effective force. It's still better than the fifth force constraints. So you can look for pseudoscalars coupled to nuclei. The QCD axion is one such particle that does that. Oh, sorry. This is an old slide. Sam's bound, sorry, this is, I forgot, I didn't update this. Sam's bound goes to 10 to the minus 8, sorry. So if I got that correctly.
It depends a little bit on what...
on what normalized
model. So I think for the...
purely hadronic QCD axion. I think...
QCD axion, then yeah.
Yeah, so...
But this GANN rather than the G. Oh, no, it's the same up to whatever.
Yeah.
If it's coupling to nucleons, it's very soon to neutrons as well. So for K.
Yeah, there's a factor of two uncertainty or model dependence in what this coupling is, but roughly the bound should be at 10 to the minus 8. Sorry.
What's the coupling? This is coupling to the spin?
This is the coupling to the spin. So this GANN is of the pseudoscalar A coupled to, it's the derivative of the axion coupled to nuclei, so gamma mu, gamma 5. So this is
So it's velocity suppressed.
No, so it's you take out the A dot piece. So in the non-relativistic limit, you get a Hamiltonian that looks like G, A, and N, A dot, and then an operator that acts on the nuclear spins dotted into the velocity operator on the nuclei. So you use the effective velocity of the nuclei in the molecule rather than the axion velocity. So there's an additional piece that's the gradient of the axion dotted into the nuclear spin that, for example, the Casper experiment looks for.
It's velocity suppressed,
but the velocity of the nuclei in a vibrational state is of order 10 to the minus 3 as well. Yeah.
Just so, what nuclear spin polarization fraction are you assuming?
Oh, I'm assuming. I'm assuming no polarization fraction. Here, I'm assuming unit polarization.
Look, you see the axion, is this range ruled out by the supernova?
This is the supernova bound, which actually the supernova bound should go to here. Yes.
This is
when we talked several months ago. Yeah, I updated the plot now, but.
Because I usually see it in the reverse way, but.
Yeah. So, but before Sam came out with this paper, actually the bound was around here. So then the QCD axion had to be lighter than 16 milliEV, but now the bound is around 0.1.
We had an error, so we. We're optimistically saying things are closer to 10 to the 7 and then wound up being more like 10 to the 8.
Okay. Maybe not the QCD axion, but things more weakly coupled. If you want to build a model that does that, go ahead.
How much model dependent it is in terms of
the supernova line? We can talk about that later.
Okay. You can also look for the same coupling, but then replace the nuclei with electrons. There's strong limits from white dwarf cooling. There's a lot more model dependence for the QCD axion. So this is the DFSE axion. This is the purely hadronic one, where you have some loop corrections inducing electron couplings. And so you can maybe probe this parameter space, like an ALP or because the QCD axion is excluded from other couplings in this range. Okay, so to conclude, I hope I've convinced you that a gas of molecules is a good makes for a good dark matter detector, because you can have a lot of handles and verify that it's a real signal. And we're sensitive to dark matter in this mass range, but for a variety of couplings and parities and spins. We're working on getting funding for a phase one prototype, and we're thinking about issues that might crop up for the phase two detectors. Thank you. Any other questions?
did you didn't tell us axion couplings to photons, right? You mentioned something about that.
Sorry, I forgot to mention. Axion couplings to photons are suppressed because you couple to E dot B, which, first of all, is a total derivative. So you take a velocity hit from there, and B is small in an atom. So we can look for it, but it's too small of an effect. But I forgot to mention Masha and Robert's idea. So they pointed out that if you take the stack detector and, sorry. You don't want to go through that again. If you take the stack detector and remove the molecules altogether, so let's say if you have vacuum and just alternating dielectrics and vacuum, and you put it in a big B field, the atom will interact with the B field and the dielectric itself, and sort of this stack of dielectrics will act like an open cavity where the dielectrics will effectively convert axions into photons there. And so it's natural to merge the two ideas.
Yeah, we'll talk about this next week.
Yeah, and so they can look for, so there will be an additive effect for hidden photons even if you don't do anything, and if you put it in a big B field, even without molecules, you can look for the coupling to photons. Yeah. With the same setup. Right? Did I say that right?
Yeah. Any more questions? Okay. So, for which of the coupling, sorry, I used something. Mm-hmm. Which of the couplings do you need to align the molecules for in the stack configuration?
So for the You mean the spins? So for
well,
the.
I mean, like, if you have these scalar couplings, presumably you need to align the molecules to get coherent.
So for the scalar couplings, the stack, in many cases, the stack detector is not good. Here, you don't need to align the molecules because here you can excite electronic transitions because you're looking. The stack. So here you're relying on the gradient.
Okay, so it's velocity suppressed.
So it's velocity. These are velocity for the stack. These are velocity suppressed.
You get a higher rate if you did align the molecules.
I think that they would still be forbidden transitions. Yeah, if it's not velocity suppressed, you don't change, say, the rotation. The parity is such that they would always be forbidden transitions unless you get some hit from velocity. So that's why the stack experiment doesn't do well. And so that's why, I mean, it's very difficult. The velocity hit is too, yeah. So for the couplings to, yeah, for all of these, you can build a stack detector. And for a coupling to photons, you can do a bulk one because you can excite electronic transitions. But yeah, so the stack detector doesn't work so well for scalars precisely because the transitions are forbidden. Yeah. Yeah.
So at this very high densities, the problem, the additional problems, where you think about collisions of molecules, because again, you get electric fields. Mm-hmm. Just internal electric fields are participating in them, right? So again, you break the parity. The, mm-hmm. For example, that scheme, it has issues. Okay, so yeah. So because you could actually, because of the parity mixing, you could go back to the ground state.
Yeah. So the photons that decay back to the ground state, you would probably not see. So you would take some hit.
Yes, that is not on this entity because, right? So you're not including that.
That depends on the molecule. So for the bulk detectors, I think I assumed throughout a sort of total efficiency of 30%.
So yeah. At these high densities, that mm-hmm. are almost like densities, you will always have these molecules interacting.
Yeah, so for the bulk phase, we assume relatively low densities and using scanning. For the stack phase, there are potential issues from the interactions between molecules, yes, at very high densities.
The low densities, you also practice collisions happening.
They will happen, and their main effect is to dephase, and they could quench, but so we calculated the quenching.
I'm not talking just about elastic collisions, right? There are...
Yeah, that's what I showed. So I showed the inelastic collision. So it's possible that in a collision, you de-excite the molecule and convert this internal energy into translational energy. So yeah, that is an issue, but so we have thought about that. Yeah, so that actually forces you, in the bulk configuration where you don't get this radiative enhancement, this means that you have to work at relatively low pressure to make sure you spontaneously emit a photon before you quench. Yeah.
For the bulk setup, what's the optical sort of depth to reabsorption for the configuration?
If it's an allowed transition, it's pretty short.
I meant the stack setup.
So it's tens of microns. What needs to be done is, if you want to have integrated thicknesses larger than, say, 10 or 30 layers, you need to worry about reabsorb. If you emit from the lower layer, you need to worry about reabsorption by the upper layer. But there isn't, so the photon could be re-emitted again in the forward direction, because the forward scattering is enhanced relative to the isotropic one. That needs to be studied. And
It's like order 30 layers or so.
That's order, 30 layers. Depends on your matrix elements, but thereabouts, yeah.
All right, great. Well, thank you for a great time.
Thanks.